How do you build a high-performing culture? This is Culture Architects, candid conversations with extraordinary leaders sharing their biggest successes, failures, and lessons learned on their culture journeys. Here's David J. Friedman.
My guest this week is Mike Burns. Mike, welcome to the show. Thanks for joining me today.
Thank you very much, David.
Most leaders develop their skills in college or in a company, but Mike did it in combat. During his distinguished military career as a Navy SEAL, Mike was involved in hundreds of combat operations around the globe. He's currently working in the world of venture capital. But Mike, I want to go back to your previous life when you were a high school lacrosse player. Talk to me about, you know, growing up. I know you grew up in South Jersey. Talk to me a little bit about growing up in New Jersey and then becoming an All-American lacrosse player at the University of North Carolina.
So grew up in South Jersey, a town called Medford. You know, noticed kind of early on that lacrosse would be a good pathway for me to pursue after high school. So throughout high school, I started looking at schools with good lacrosse programs, was fortunate enough to get recruited by a few different ones, but ultimately selected University of North Carolina. I just loved everything about it down there from the moment I stepped on campus. And those 4 years there were amazing. I wish I could go back now knowing all I know about leadership and all that. And while I was the captain there my senior year at North Carolina, wish I could have those days back. But
and why do you say that?
I just think that I would have been a little bit better of a leader and been had my priorities focused on more important things like winning games, if that makes sense.
Yes. Any of us that went to college know that. And I'll be curious, we'll come back to that because I want to ask more about, so what did you learn as a captain there? But let's go beyond that. So you got out of school and what was next?
So the big thing to do at North Carolina is kind of a lot of folks go into banking afterwards. They have a great business school there. And a lot of people from UNC go up to New York City. So that was my goal. And ultimately ended up getting a job at Morgan Stanley doing a sales and trading function. And I thought that it was going to be this, fast-paced teamwork, team environment. And it turned out not to be that. And I found myself kind of as a sheep who followed the herd and did what everyone else was doing and was unhappy after about 6 months there. I kind of have an interesting story, rewind a little bit. My interview process, the last guy that I interviewed with after, a full day of interviews was a guy, I won't mention his name, but he was a former SEAL and he ran the sales and trading desk there. And he looked at me, he goes, "Why do you want to do this job?" And I gave some typical interview answer. And then he asked me what I like to do for fun. And I gave him, all the things I like to do for fun, which are surf, hang out with my friends, run, swim, all that. And he said, "You can't do any of those things here."
Great job.
Yeah. And I gave him some other BS answer after that. And he said, "Listen, I was a former SEAL and it was the best time of my entire life as a young guy. I'm going to hire you, but we're going to work on getting you into officer candidate school and then ultimately onto BUDS." And, being a 22 or 23 year old kid, I just said, yes, of course, because I needed the job. But then it ultimately turned into that. And I spent about 11 months there. I got accepted to OCS and off I went into the Navy.
So when you told your parents that, or your mother that, "Hey, this job I've got at Morgan Stanley and that the guy who hired me says he's going to prepare me to be a Navy SEAL," like what was your mother's reaction to that?
She was a bit nervous. She didn't really know all that much about the military, and there was a lot of convincing I had to do on her part because, one of my biggest goals growing up was to, I grew up with only my mom. So as you can imagine, her raising two kids was difficult. And my whole goal in life was to basically minimize the stress on her. And how I was going to accomplish that was
going to the Navy SEALs.
Exactly. Yeah. But, just trying to be successful and whatever that means, it means different things to different people, but basically just having her not worry about me. And this was kind of the opposite of that in her eyes. She worries about her little baby going off to war. And it took a bit for me to get her comfortable with it.
So when this person who hired you said, "You need to be a Navy SEAL and I'm going to hire you, but I'm going to prepare you to go off to officer candidate school," Of course, you said yes because you want the job. When you said yes, do you remember, like, were you thinking, I'm not doing that? Or were you thinking, yeah, hey, I'm up for that?
To be honest, I kind of thought, like, no chance I'm going to do that. I'm going to get comfortable in this role and then just work my way up. And I think over the course of that, you know, 5 or 6 months where I said I was unhappy, I realized, you know, I'm too young to be sitting here with a bunch of other folks that maybe feel a little trapped or dislike their job. And I just didn't want to become that guy who just settled for something.
Yeah. So you go off to officer candidate school after a year at Morgan Stanley, roughly. And how long is officer candidate school?
That is 3 months, and it takes place up in Newport, Rhode Island. So I was up there during the winter, and it was pretty cold.
And then that leads you to BUDS and then on to the SEAL program.
Yes, that leads you to BUDS. So you go off to Coronado, California, go through first, second, third phase of BUDS, which is kind of the weed out process. And then once you get done BUDS, you go to what's called SQT or SEAL qualification training. And that's where you really learn the tools for the toolbox, and they start teaching you how to be a SEAL and getting you ready to be a contributing member in your platoon that you show up at once you graduate SQT.
Got it. And how long were you part of the SEALs?
So I was in the SEAL teams for what would be probably 6.5-7 years. And then my whole time in the Navy was around 8.5 years.
And is that pretty typical when people are in the SEALs? Is there a time period which they say, you know, typically it's 5, 8, 10 years and then they're out? Or do people spend a lot longer there?
It's really different for everybody. And I think, you know, life happens differently for everybody. So, and also people's priorities are change over time. So where I thought that maybe I would do a full career when I first got in, having a wife and kid, as you know, I have, definitely changes the game a little bit. You know, when you're gone for deployments that are lasting 6 months, and then when you are back home and stateside, you're constantly gone for 3 weeks at a time and then home for one. And that's just super tough on the family, and not something that I wanted to have happen to Mackenzie and my son.
Yeah, I can understand that. So let me ask you one question about the SEALs. Then I want to go back to North Carolina and what you learned there, wishing, or what you know now that you wish you knew then from a leadership and culture standpoint. So Navy SEALs, of course, as you well know, is, you know, that's something people look up to and they read about, they see movies about it. So, and most of us don't know anything about the SEALs other than what we see in the movies. What's one thing that might maybe surprise people about the culture of the SEALs? What would we not expect?
I think one thing that you wouldn't expect is, you know, when you read these books and see stuff in the news and you think of SEALs kind of like pirates, guys that are a little bit off the reservation, not abiding by military rules and or not all of the military rules and kind of have free reign. And it's pretty far from that. The other thing would be the diversity piece. If you look at it, you know, we're really well set up to invade Canada or like Norway or something like that. Mm-hmm. But with what we lack in, you know, ethnic diversity, we make up in the diversity of culture and diversity of backgrounds, upbringing, and stuff like that. For example, I had in my platoons, I had enlisted guys that were Harvard grads. I had guys with PhDs. On the other hand, I had guys that were first generation Americans, not graduating college. I had an Iowa State cattle roping champion, and all those different backgrounds and the diversity of those backgrounds make a pretty special thing when you bring everyone together and those shared experiences, if you know what I mean.
Mm. Mm. So what's the common denominator? I mean, that would surprise me certainly that you'd go from somebody who barely got out of school to somebody who's a Harvard grad or a PhD. What's the common denominator that makes them SEALs?
I think it's a combination of grit and just mental fortitude. Mental fortitude is kind of a tough one to define, but the hardest thing about BUDS, in my opinion, is just how mentally grueling it is. There's a lot of physical stuff, obviously. You have to be good at that, and you have to hope you don't get hurt, but the duration of time that you do things really wears on guys. And when you're constantly doing physical evolutions one after the other, some guys can't get past the fact that like at a point in time, it's going to end. You're going to have to eat. They're going to have to send you to a meal. They're going to have to put you in the ocean and cool you down or something like that. And some guys just can't get past that and see the light at the end of the tunnel.
Interesting. So let's go back to North Carolina. So you were captain of the lacrosse team at North Carolina, and you made the comment earlier that, you know, you wish you knew now, you wish you could do it over knowing what you know now. So how would you describe your leadership style as captain back then?
Yeah, I think it was more in the lane of do as I do. And I wasn't really taking into account the different skill levels of all the guys. And by no means was I the best player, but for my position, I thought I performed pretty well. And I was thankful enough to be, you know, given the God-given abilities to perform athletically at a pretty high level compared to some of my peers. And I wasn't always sympathetic to others that weren't able to do that. And I kind of had a hands-off approach, basically just trying to lead from the front and not helping and being that servant leader that I later became to be. I wish I had, you know, helped my buddies and my teammates a lot more there, become, you know, better versions of themselves. Another thing, I guess, is I was trying to be too much of a people pleaser. I thought that as a leader, as long as they liked me, then I was being a good leader. And that just, what I learned, isn't the case.
Yeah. So, how were you chosen as captain?
It's a voting process. And I think that, you know, it's maybe a bit of a popularity contest, kind of as I alluded to before. And that's not the best way to choose a leader. You need to, you know, not everybody needs to like that person ultimately, but they need to have trust and faith that they're going to, you know, act in their, in this case, my player's best interest.
Yeah. So when you were on that team, the coach of the team, was it, you don't tell me his name, but was that a good coach? Did you think that that person set a strong culture for the team, or was that pretty much hands off?
You know, I hope he doesn't listen to this, but I would say that there was a lot of false motivation and not enough mentorship. I wish I had a little bit more mentorship there and kind of some guidance, you know, because at the end of the day, like, I can't even begin to explain how much I've learned over the course of, you know, from when I was 21 to now being 33. And at 21, looking back at myself, like, I didn't know anything. And I was just kind of, you know, figuring it out on my own as I go. And there really wasn't that much talk around culture and leadership at that time.
Interesting. I have a niece who played soccer at UNC. And of course, I'm sure you're well aware of the legendary program that they have in women's soccer there.
Absolutely.
Anson Dorrance, the coach there, I've spent some time with him. And on their team, they have a very specific set of values that they teach and they drill and they practice. And in fact, they have an award Anson was telling me about. They have an award that is the most prestigious award you can win on the team for the player who best embodies the values of the team in the eyes of their peers. And so living to a set of values and practicing in a certain way was really core to, or is core to, how that team operates. And of course, they've won, I don't know, 20 national champions or something like that. So inferring from your comments, there was nothing like that going on the lacrosse team.
No, you're absolutely right. There was no set of core values. There was no ethos. There was no curriculum to better us as, you know, as leaders at a young age. And I think we could have really benefited from it. You know, at North Carolina, there's a leadership academy that they started kind of, I guess it was halfway through my time there, that was starting to revamp that leadership process, really start to talk about leadership and help the student athletes. But I would have really loved to have one that was specific to our lacrosse team and gotten the buy-in of all the guys on our squad.
Yeah. So we'll contrast that with, so you go off to officer candidate school, and of course, that's all about leadership. What did you learn in officer candidate school about as becoming a leader, and in particular, how to build a culture in a platoon or a group of people that you're leading?
You know, to be honest, you should ask me that question in relation to BUDS versus officer candidate school. Because okay. officer candidate school is basically just the officer version of boot camp. It's getting you indoctrinated into the Navy And while they probably tell you or will advertise that there's some leadership stuff there, it's really just trying to keep your head down, not get in trouble, and make it off to Buds afterwards.
All right. So it's in Buds where you first start to experience what does leadership and culture look like.
Absolutely. Absolutely. What I quickly learned in Buds was that the first couple weeks, it's really every man for himself. Or you initially think that, like, okay, I just need to get through these first couple weeks, which are the hardest, and they're typically where the most guys drop out. And, you know, I thought to myself, Mike, you just need to like do you and get yourself past this. What I quickly learned after thinking that was Buds is designed so that thought is impossible. You cannot look after yourself unless you look after your buddies. Mm-hmm. And you can't succeed unless you're working together as your team. And the only way to do that is by, like I just said, looking after your buddies. Because if the whole unit isn't functioning optimally, even one weak link in that chain, you're going to fail and you're going to fall behind. And then you're going to get a little bit extra treatment by the instructors, as they call it. So
that's interesting. So you learned from experience, from needing to learn, that the only way I'm going to survive this is if we work as a team together. Were there things that you were taught in that process, whether in Buds or even once you got out of Buds and became actually a SEAL, were there things that you were taught more overtly, like these are the principles under which we're going to operate here? Or was it more just, you know, you figured this stuff out because that was the only way to survive?
Throughout the whole time in Buds, you're kind of, what's drilled into you is the SEAL ethos. And that's just the guiding principles of the SEALs. And if you haven't read it, I would encourage you to. It's a pretty good, you know, pretty good document and kind of is the guiding light that we all, you know, shine to abide by or try to abide by. And so that's just drilled into you throughout the whole time in Buds. And there's different things that happen along the way where those principles are really instilled and you realize that, okay, this document actually means something. It's here for, these words are here for a reason. Each word is specifically there for a reason. And it's kind of just throughout that whole process that your leadership style kind of changes, if that makes sense.
Yeah. For the benefit of our audience, can you share a few of those principles and how examples of how you learn those or how they talk about them and teach them and make them part of daily life?
Yeah. And so this is kind of my first taste of servant leadership. I'm assuming, you know, being the culture guy that you are, you know, mm-hmm. Sure. A little bit about servant leadership. That's kind of the flavor of the whole SEAL ethos. You know, some little excerpts from that are, will not seek recognition for my actions. I have uncompromising integrity as my standard. My character and honor is steadfast. My word is my bond. It's stuff like that. It's really just making sure that you are looking out for the team and you are not in any way looking for the self-recognition. And it's really not about you. It's about the SEAL teams, your platoon, and ultimately your buddies.
Yeah. You know, one of the things that we talk about a lot and I write a lot about in my books is the importance of not only defining principles like those that you've just outlined, but in order to get them to be internalized by people, the importance of creating what I call rituals around them, routines and practices that teach these things. So I think of things as simple that, you know, we all grew up, at least I grew up certainly, you know, saying the Pledge of Allegiance every morning, and you stop and you think about what that really means. But when you do these things in a routine way, they start to become indoctrinated in us. I always think of the military. I did not serve in the military, but I think of the military as one of the most effective examples of building culture and building structure and routine and ritual around how we do certain things. So what are some of the rituals that would happen on a SEAL team as a way of indoctrinating these principles?
So, you know, aside from in Buds, aside from the obvious one, which is the physical remediation, if you mess one of these things up or you act in a way that's out of line with this.
Physical remediation. I like that description.
Yeah, with this ethos, you'll definitely experience that. But then I think one of the coolest things, and one of the guys that I look up to more than anybody in the SEAL teams was so effective at, is he was so effective in and making the right thing to do cool. Mm. And, you know, you think back when you were a kid and in grade school or something, like people would pick on the nerds and they thought it wasn't cool to do well mm-hmm. in school. Like that's an old way of thinking. But as I got older and as I learned from countless individuals who are really good at defining culture and making culture in platoons, it's like they made the right thing to do really cool. And mm-hmm. that's how you showed how professional you were and how competent you were. And yeah, I think that was probably, you know, the biggest thing that I learned.
Uh-huh. So who was, you don't have to tell me names, but especially since they're SEALs, but give me an example of one or two people who were leaders that you look up to the most and say, well, that person was a great example of what leadership should be. And I learned so much from that person.
Yeah. So the first example is my first platoon chief. And for those who aren't familiar with the military, there's kind of two sides, officer and enlisted. And the leadership of a platoon, you have a platoon chief as the enlisted guy, who's kind of the senior enlisted person. And then you have the officer in charge, who's typically a lieutenant within that platoon. And those guys work hand in hand. The enlisted or senior enlisted guy, the chief, is in charge of kind of the tactics and stuff like that. He typically has more time in the Navy. It, you know, it takes somewhere between 10 to 15 years or so to become a chief, whereas a lieutenant could only have been in the Navy for 4 years and, you know, he holds that rank. But based on how stuff was set up way, way long ago, the officers are in charge of the platoon. So anyway, long story short, my platoon chief at my first platoon was just my biggest mentor for sure. I kept myself in his back pocket when I was a new guy in a platoon, and I just wanted to learn everything that he knew. I saw how he carried himself was so professional, and people respected him, looked up to him. And I was just like, I want to be like that. He's probably the biggest one. And then there's, you know, countless others that I've encountered throughout my time in the SEAL teams. But I think it all comes back to like the idea of making the right thing look cool and getting buy-in from the guys.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, I'm always curious about one of the things that one of the many things that makes the military so different from, I'll call it civilian life, is you have this ability to order people, and you must do this. So they don't have any choice. They have to do what you say. And that creates a very different dynamic for leadership. I'm sure you don't want to always be having them only do something because you told them they had to, but you do have that leverage over people as an officer, I'm assuming, that you give them orders and they have to do them. How does that change, do you think, the way in which you lead? If at all, maybe it doesn't, but how does it affect the way in which you lead in the military versus now that you're in civilian life?
In the military, it really should never come to giving an order, you know, unless somebody really just has zero buy-in with you and zero trust and faith in you as a leader. It should never come to you having to give an order to somebody. You should help them come to that decision on their own and kind of help them understand that this is the right thing to do, and here's why it's the right thing to do, and here's how it's going to benefit us as a group in the long run. Mm-hmm. You know, the second half of your question, how does that translate over to the civilian life? Mm-hmm. It's definitely not as easy because people sometimes don't have to listen to you, or they're not mm-hmm. going to listen to you. There's no repercussions because of it. It's sometimes harder to get your point across and feel comfortable as a leader in a non-military setting, kind of mm-hmm. directing somebody to do something.
Yeah. I mean, ultimately the ultimate leverage that you have, and I say leverage not to be used in a manipulative way, but ultimately the leverage you have, you know, in the military is they don't have a choice. They don't have a choice about being there right now. They've enlisted and they're there and they can't quit. They can't say, you know what, I'm not taking this. I think I'm going to leave. Where in the civilian life, you know what? If they don't like following you, they could choose to go to another place to work.
Exactly.
And that makes it certainly much more difficult to create that kind of accountability, as you're pointing out.
Yeah, exactly. And you see right now with the labor shortage, right? People mm-hmm. are just quitting their jobs throughout the pandemic. People are just quitting left and right. And if somebody doesn't want to do something, they can just say, you know what, sayonara.
Yeah, that makes it a lot harder from a leadership perspective. All right, Mike, hang on just a minute, because we have to stop right here. But coming up in the second part of my conversation with Mike Burns, Mike shares the skills that he acquired as a Navy SEAL that are helping him today in life and in business.
Things just don't stress me out as much anymore, and I'm super thankful for that. And when I see people, you know, whether I work with them or at home or out in town, I just have to think to myself, like, why are you so stressed about that? You just have to take a step back and think about how you're going to solve it, what the solution is, versus, oh my God, I have this crazy big problem. Okay, take a step back and solve it.
This has been Culture Architects with David J. Friedman. Be sure to join us next time for more insights and wisdom from great leaders from all walks of life. To book David for your events or to learn more about his writing, speaking, or consulting, go to davidjfriedman.com. Culture Architects with David J. Friedman is a production of Forbes Books.